Great. Welcome, everyone. Welcome to Sound Slash Text. I'm Sophie Sater. I'm one of the co-organizers with Alex Redding. We're really excited to have you all here tonight for a really exciting talk. So Sound Slash Text was set up as a space to explore the intersections of language, music, and noise from experimental poetry to sound archives, conceptual art, sonic anthropology, material culture, and also practice-based research. And we've hosted a number of different events that tried to bring together sort of theory and practice and thinking about sort of sound and text from a number of different angles. So we had some academic talks. We also had a roundtable on sound as knowledge. We had a lecture performance. We also hosted a sound poet and artist Caroline Bergvall. So we've had like a number of different perspectives. So it's really our core interest to bring theory and practice together and make an intervention in current debates about sound and in a number of disciplines, but also in kind of contemporary practices, art practices, and activist practices. So I'll hand over to Alex to introduce Alex Corey. But yeah, welcome from me.
Thanks so much. I'm Alex Redding. I am the co-host of Sound Slash Text, and it's my great pleasure to introduce Alex Corey, our speaker today. Alex is a contingent faculty member at Harvard University, where they teach in history and literature, and at UMass Boston, where they teach in American studies. Alex received their PhD in English from the University of Colorado Boulder, where they served as manager of the Laboratory for Race and Popular Culture from 2013 to 17. And their research considers how the gendering of sound leads into and emerges out of the racial dynamics of US musical culture. Alex's recent publications include Sounding Out Racial Difference in the Routledge Companion to Sound Studies, and an article entitled The Reverberating Flesh, Refiguring Blackness and Sex in Ralph Ellison's Musical Basements, which is forthcoming in Arizona Quarterly. And Alex is also currently working on a book, which is called Hysterical Melodies, Sex and the Music of Black Modernism, which examines how discourses of binary sex affect the racialization of US musical culture. And today's talk is titled Toward a Trans Listening Practice. Please join me in welcoming Alex Corey.
Hi. hello. So hopefully people can hear me. This is the first time I've given kind of an extended Zoom talk, but I've taught a lot on Zoom, so I'm relatively familiar with looking at a screen full of names. But it's lovely to see so many of you that I know here. And so today I'll be talking about some very new work. It's part of my book project that's in process. The book's called, as Alex just said, Hysterical Melodies, Sex and the Music of Black Modernism. And it examines how these discourses of binary sex affect the racial implications of musical culture. I study musicians and authors in the book, including James Weldon Johnson, Ralph Ellison, Edith Wilson, Philippa Schuyler, John Coltrane, and Aretha Franklin, trying to show how concerns about a permeable boundary between male and female became audible as a motivating force, not a secondary effect in the division of musical culture along racial lines. The manuscript begins at the beginning of the 20th century when musical culture, in that moment when musical culture was increasingly organized along racial lines in the US, it was a moment also when perceptions of a racial group's capacity for proper sexual differentiation were fundamental to dominant assumptions about racial hierarchies. And at the same time, critics, especially a lot of white music critics, worried that music made by both Black and white musicians threatened to sow hysteria among the listening public. Hysterical Melodies demonstrates how performers and readers and listeners found themselves situated in relation to this male-female binary through their relationship to musical sound. The relationship to sex difference inflected, but was not reducible to their racial positioning. So the archive of the book consists of unpublished drafts, personal correspondence, annotated sheet music, commercial recordings, and published fiction. these materials allow me to study not only the commodified products of the musicians, you know, books and albums they might have sold, concerts they might have performed, sheet music, etc., but also their creative process. And studying the creative processes of Black modernist artists is important because it clarifies how these artists mobilized assumptions between music and sexual differentiation in ways that made the negotiation of binary sex into one of music's core racial concerns. The chapters move among fictional depictions of classical piano performance, silent invocations of Edith Wilson blues recordings, startling annotations on Beethoven piano scores, recorded improvisations on The Sound of Music, and also some of Aretha Franklin's recordings. So today I'll be speaking from a section that's on how trans analytics can inflect analyses of the racial stakes of pop music. My focus is on Aretha Franklin's recording of You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman, which was released on her 1967 album, Lady Soul. And so since the book is in progress, I will say I'm not entirely sure where this is going to fit. This is one of the things I'm hoping to learn a little bit more about today. Right? It might be a final chapter if I choose a chronological organization for the book, but it might also be part of the introduction as a way of foregrounding the methodological interventions of the project and for clarifying the payoff for its overall argument. So here goes. The question I want to begin with is this: how might we craft a trans analytic to engage with US music history, one that doesn't start or end with the attempt to recover trans-identifying artists or material that directly names transness as its subject, or maybe worse, its object? I'm trying to pick up here on threads from Cameron Awkward Rich, C. Riley Snorton, and Alexander Eastwood, who've asked similar questions about broader literary and cultural history. Right? What does history look like? And for our purposes here, what does it sound like when we start from a trans subject position? And a reason that I'm asking these questions is that trans studies takes a different orientation toward narratives of gender and sexual difference than does queer theory. But queer theoretical methodologies tend to underpin the dominant paradigm for thinking about music in American studies. This is in part due to the institutional strength of queer theory and queer studies today. A number of trans studies scholars have written about this. They've written about the way that trans studies tends to be treated institutionally as like a province within queer studies, rather than appositional to queer studies or kind of running alongside or parallel to, or actually in some ways separate from. Cale Egan recently summed it up quite well. Right? Queer theory tends to prioritize the study of performativity in ways that deconstruct the coherence of gender categories. And this remains, I think, quite important, especially in scholarship on music. But trans studies largely treats claims about a subject's relation to gender as constitutive, as indexing a relation to gender that's not reducible simply to the performative act. So trans study then invites us to ask how processes of gender self-determination, which are not always performative, can both enact and articulate alongside and through the material effects of racialization. And I will say here, right, this is a little bit of a schematic way of understanding the difference between queer studies and trans studies, and in particular, queer of color critique and trans of color critique move across this boundary that I'm setting up. But I'm really focusing on the institutional focus of queer studies here, which is why I'm trying to draw that out. So I'm following Jules Gill Peterson in suggesting that my aim is not to assert the primacy of trans over queer, but rather to demonstrate how trans studies can generate different questions that open otherwise modes of knowing. Right here, I'm using otherwise in a way that draws on Ashaun Crawley's use of it to refer to the ways that these are not new or alternative necessarily, but actually like already alive and enfleshed and present ways of knowing, even as they might not be fully articulable in language. And I belabor the point about trans versus queer because the concerns of trans studies routinely remain siloed within isolated corners of the university. Whereas the current institutional presence of queer studies means that work in all sorts of departments and disciplines use queer methodologies. But when the institutionally sanctioned version of queer studies routinely treats claims to gendered positionality as suspicious or inadequate or even false consciousness, It functions to exclude not only trans methodologies, but also at times trans practitioners who would prefer that their gender not be a topic of academic debate within institutions that are already hostile in myriad structural ways to the existence of trans people. And so I say this as a person who, you know, on a campus visit for a job that was supposed to be working towards LGBTQ equity at a university, but I was in the midst of a campus visit for this, and I was pretty clearly and intentionally sent to a sex segregated bathroom during this campus visit after having spent significant time in the interview talking about the problem of navigating sex segregated bathrooms for trans non-binary people like me. Unsurprisingly, I didn't get that job, which was probably for the best, but that's just one example. When I told this story to other, you know, trans colleagues, everyone was like, oh yeah, you know, that moment, many of us have had that. And so I'm more interested here, especially in what follows, I'm going to talk about Franklin, in strategies for narrativizing race and gendered experience and tactics that people employ for navigating hostile words than I am in the psychic processes of identification. I'm really interested in the material ways that people do stuff. So where practitioners of queer theory have asked time and again what the spectral figure of the transsexual can teach us about historical arrangements of sexuality and gendered power, trans studies scholars might ask, as C. Riley Snorton does, how transitive grammars and transitive logics bring Blackness and transness into fleeting alignments grounded in material circumstances. Snorton calls attention to the multiple registers of transitivity in his book, Black on Both Sides. On one level, transitive for Snorton refers to passing from one state into another, not lasting or transient, a quality of fleetingness or ephemerality. But on another level, transitive names a grammatical function in which something needs a direct object to complete its sense of meaning. Snorton's emphasis on transitivity can orient us toward pop music in a way that attunes us to moments of transition and transitivity, to the fleeting alignments of Blackness and transness in the stories that popular music tells, even when the subject who may be singing the story is not necessarily trans. And with Cameron Awkward Rich, I'm listening for narratives of transformation in feeling and being that might not triumphantly transcend pain, but do in some sense reconfigure a subject's relationship to it through the mode of that subject's telling. And with Aaron Azura, I'm listening for moments when the stories told in popular song raise the specter of gender indeterminacy, the transitive moment when someone or something passes into another state in ways that are not the spectacular moments of transition that kind of saturate popular representations of transness. Rather, these are the more everyday types of gendered care which take place within racialized worlds that trans communities practice in specific ways, but ways which speak beyond those of us who are trans. One such artist who tells this kind of story is Aretha Franklin, and one such song is her 1967 recording of "You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman." This is a song that's about transition. It's about the gendered and racialized movement away from an unchosen and an untenable starting place. More precisely, it's also about a fundamental transformation in the narrator's felt and lived experience of gender, but I would argue maybe not necessarily gender identity. As Aaron Azura reminds us, narratives of transition do not transparently reflect psychic processes. Right? They're strategic. They're telling a story in a way that's meant to land to someone else. So it's a song that deeply engages with the way that naming a wrongness felt about one's relationship to binary gender can instigate movement across and against not only structural barriers to flourishing, but also barriers to living at all. It's a song about how embodied intimacy and recognition can animate a sense of aliveness. Therefore, it's a claim to life within a biopolitical regime in which being racialized as Black both precludes access to unmarked womanhood and positions one closer to premature death, because as far as the state is concerned, hers is a life not worth sustaining. So it's a song then about care in hostile circumstances, about the way that modes of embodied care can enliven us. What I mean is that the feeling of gendered recognition in a natural woman co-articulates in and as a feeling alive, receptive to sensation, when the material circumstances surrounding this articulation aim to prevent that kind of perceptual receptivity and its enlivened expression. Just so that you don't have to listen to my voice for too long in a row, I'm going to actually play it. I was going to wait to play it. We're going to play it a couple times. Part of that, because I want to be thinking about, like, what is the research process for producing a project like this? What's listening to the damn thing a million times and trying to figure out what's going on and how to write about it and think about it without anatomizing it, which I'll talk about a little bit later. But with that in mind, I am going to play the song and then I'll get back to the talk.
Looking out on the morning rain, I used to feel so uninspired. And when I knew I had to face another day, Lord, it made me feel so tired. Before the day I met you, life was so unkind. And you're the key to
It's a tough act to try to start talking again after that song, listening to Aretha Franklin sing there. But just remember where we were before I played it. Right, we were talking about biopolitics in blackness in the 1960s. Right, so one place to see this biopolitical regime take discursive shape around the moment that the song was released is the 1965 Moynihan Report. Moynihan's report was released 2 years prior to Franklin's single. And broadly, this report, it was a government report that pathologizes Black people, especially Black men, as psychically damaged due to the matriarchal family structure of that Moynihan tries to point out among Black communities. And Moynihan argues that the pathway to racial equality in the United States is through restoring a mythical kind of two-parent family structure in which to raise Black children, in particular to raise Black boys. without dwelling too much on the report, I am going to say, like, I'm following Hortense Spillers here and talking about thinking about the way the Moynihan Report makes Black femaleness into a civilizational problem while systematically denying Black women the capacity to feel much of anything at all. Within the report, Black women figure exclusively as instruments of social reproduction, but not as subjects in their own right. So in this context, one might hear Franklin as responding to Moynihan's dismissal of Black women, to borrow from Spiller's formulation, not by trying to join the ranks of gendered femaleness, Spillers puts it, but by, quote, gaining the insurgent ground as female social subject, end quote. Right? There's an insurgency there to the celebration of feeling like a natural woman, in part because of the emphasis on feeling as something to be celebrated and to hold on to, which articulated against and as respite from the feeling like a problem that Black womanhood entails. So my approach to natural woman, a natural woman, departs fundamentally from Judith Butler's writing on it, which was published very soon after Spillers's Mama's Baby, Papa's Maybe. Butler positioned Franklin squarely in the ranks of raceless, which is to say white, gendered femaleness. They offered a reading of Aretha's singing that somehow left out any discussion of Blackness and therefore took the song as universally emblematic of the way that white heteronormative fantasies of identity work. For Butler, the motivation for Franklin's desire to feel like a natural woman stems from an unproblematized continuity among sex, gender, and heterosexuality. Butler then asserts that Franklin seems, quote, all too glad to have naturalness confirmed, end quote. Yet Franklin is also fully and paradoxically mindful of naturalness's contingency. But Butler doesn't make any reference either to the way that Franklin sings or the fact that she's singing words mostly written by someone else. For Butler, Franklin's celebration of feeling like a natural woman is an ephemeral act or effect of an instance of what she calls heterosexual recognition. Butler turns this reading on the word like, of the titular phrase, "You make me feel like a natural woman." Putting pressure on that word like, Butler concludes that Franklin performs, quote, a metaphorical substitution, an act of imposture that rehearses the mundane operation of heterosexual drag. And this strikes me as a profound mishearing of the song, not just because Butler doesn't actually write anything about the song as a song. I'm not alone in critiquing Butler here on these grounds. Margaret Homans critiques them, for instance, because Butler positioned Franklin as yet another Black woman who's supposedly copying a white womanhood from which she was structurally barred. And somewhat more recently, Judith Ann Perino also rebuffed Butler's misreading of Franklin on the ground that Butler had nothing to say about Franklin's actual way of singing. Franklin is simply a conduit through which Butler could elaborate their own theory of raceless gender at this moment. Both of these critiques make the very important point that Butler's theory of iterative performativity says nothing about either the labor of Aretha's performance or the conditions in which she labored as a Black woman. And just one thing I'm going to say here is, you know, Judith Butler's thinking has changed a lot since they initially wrote this, I'm not trying to say that, like, Butler's necessarily still would argue these same things. I'm saying this is a canonical reading or listening to the song that we actually really need to grapple with in order to shift from a queer studies mindset toward it, towards a trans studies mindset towards it. So what do we hear when we don't abstract the details of Aretha's performance into vague inferences about her interiority? Here, Aaron Azura's critique of Jay Prosser's important writing on trans autobiography is helpful. As Azura argues it, when Prosser reads autobiographies of gender transition, he misreads narrative strategies as transparent reflections of the psychic process of transition. So instead, I want to hear the transitive properties of the phrase following Snorton, "You make me feel like a natural woman," the way that this phrase circulates through Blackness and femaleness in their co-articulation, right? So I guess what I'm trying to say here is, rather than considering the song as a reflection of a psychic process of identification, I want to hear it as a strategic narration of how one navigates a fundamentally hostile, racialized world. So with that shift in place, we'd likely note that Aretha is singing about how she feels about the you who makes her feel it. But I also want to be careful here because my aim isn't to anatomize the different ways that she sings it or to strive for a kind of knowing possession of Franklin's voice. I'm thinking here with Suzanne Cusick, whose 1993 essay on a lesbian relationship with music critiques masculinist musicology for its emphasis on knowing dismemberment of music into its constitutive parts, and instead proposes a mode of extreme attentiveness that invites the music to wash over us for us to think about it in the power, pleasure, intimacy triad that she calls, as she calls it. So with that in mind, I want to dwell on the work that Franklin does with the word feel, because she's given us a gift that's worth sitting with here. She sings the word feel 18 times in less than 3 minutes on this recording. And she hardly sings it the same way twice. At times it sounds like she's almost singing it two different ways at once. Sometimes it's followed by a word that names an emotion or a description of an emotional orientation to the world. Still other times she just stops at feel and returns to the beginning of the phrase. And I actually think that's really important. The notion of being able made to feel is actually substantively different than being made to feel like a natural woman, because that's a transformation from a depressive numbness to a feeling of enlivenedness. She repeats the words, but transforms the feel of her phrasing. She accentuates different words, shapes the line subtly differently. There are these kind of little understated melismas which articulate against the way that Franklin is known for her kind of virtuosic melismatic singing elsewhere. And still other times it is followed by this phrase, like a natural woman. So overall, she charts a transformation from narrating depressive feelings toward narrating and singing about and performing exuberance and aliveness. At the beginning of the song, her diction and phrasing is measured. So when she sings in the first verse, I used to feel so uninspired. Lord, it made me feel so tired. And at the end of the song, the feelings she names are ecstatic, her diction and phrasing heightened. You made me feel so good inside. You make me feel so alive in the late bridge. In all her variations, Franklin sketches this range of feeling, a range that positions feeling like a natural woman as the condition of possibility for, or maybe even just a placeholder for, the more direct naming of another feeling that matters. This direct naming arrives at the conclusion of the bridge towards the end of the song on the phrase, "You make me feel so alive." The full line is, I want to be close to you. You make me feel so alive. And the way she sings it is just, it's totally breathtaking. Not only in the way that she shapes it, but also the way that she leaves out the "the" sound that concludes alive, making it sound almost like she's singing "so a lie." It's not entirely like, unlike how she finishes some other words that end with D or T sounds earlier in the song, except that the difference between how a body makes a "the" sound and a "duh" sound means that the V can be sustained ghost-like as the breath leaves the body, but the hardness of the "duh" is fleeting. So in this context, her enunciation conjures the radiance of the word "alight," but in the negative space of the absent "the." So the ghost of the "the" still haunts the word. It really is alive. You really do make me feel so alive. Moreover, the background vocalists in this moment who've been echoing her lead through the bridge on "what you've done to me, good inside and wanna be," stay silent, facilitating a forcefully unified, but not unison collective return to "you make me feel" of the final chorus. And the point of all this is that Franklin directly connects a transformation in her felt relation to gender with a transition in her felt relation to aliveness and embodiment. Love, as I'll argue in the next section, is what gets her there, but it's a love she accesses by refusing to name it. Before we go there, though, I want to listen through the whole song again, because I've now kind of given some suggestions of what to listen to. And it's always worth listening again. I was planning to select clips, but I couldn't really bring myself to do it. So here we will listen again. And as we listen, I will encourage people to listen to the different ways that she sings and emphasizes and kind of contours the word "feel."
Looking out
Okay, so it's a little noted fact that when Aretha Franklin recorded You Make Me Feel Like an Actual Woman in February of 1967, she removed the love from it. Not love as a feeling or practice, or that kind of Baldwinian sense of love as a painful but necessary mode of sustaining life together in otherwise untenable conditions. No, I mean the word love, which Jerry Goffin had written as central to the lyrics of the song's first verse, and which Carole King had emphatically enunciated in her demo recording of the song. "Your love was the key to my peace of mind," King sings, as her plodding piano chords gather steam to carry us into the chorus in the demo. In maintaining the past tense here, King continues the backward glance of the song's opening verse and setup. Though the song begins its story with the present action of looking out on the morning rain, the verse as a whole casts the act of looking out as parallel to a looking back. Looking out enables a looking back, which is to say that the present tenseness of looking out throws the pastness of the negative feelings into relief. Having been uninspired, tired, life was so unkind, etc., here we might note how the spatialization of a gaze out animates a temporal attention back to the moment before the emotional transition. And so when King continues the past tense in her singing of "Your love was the key to my peace of mind," she defers and therefore amplifies the arrival of the present tense in the chorus in all of its transitive force. You make me feel, you make me feel, you make me feel like a natural woman. I'm going to play the first minute or so of Carole King, just so you can hear what I'm talking about.
I think your mic is off. Yeah.
Eek, sorry. I turned my mic off, but it is back on, I think. Can you hear me now? Great. But Franklin excises the phrase that both names love and positions it in the past. And at the same time, Franklin transforms the possessive word "your" into a one-syllable condensation of "you" and "are." By doing this, she locates the process in the present moment as ongoing. This modification reconfigures the temporal landscape of the song's story, because the present tense arrives in the lyric before the transitive "you make me feel" in Franklin's version. You are the key for Franklin, you and your embodied presence, granting me access to a certain peace of mind. You and your full you-ness know not perhaps the fantasy of the love plot, but also the pain and jaggedness of love as practices, to borrow a phrase and a concept from Cameron Awkward Rich. Your proximity and recognition are both the precondition for and the driver of me feeling like a natural woman. This transformation of the first verse shifts the ground for the remaining lyrics as well, especially the second verse. Although peace of mind arrives in the present, in Franklin's version, the capacity to name a felt wrongness arrived in the past and therefore precedes that peace of mind. Right? She sings, "I didn't know just what was wrong with me till your kiss helped me name it." that the past love of Carole King's version of the song could unlock an ongoing peace of mind is the fantastical stuff of the love plot, a plot that Cameron Awkward Rich argues smooths over the roughness of love as a practice. And I'm much more interested here than in how the ephemerality of a kiss could provoke the naming of something that language had not been able to touch, and how a recognition that produces a feeling like can precipitate a feeling alive. And here's one of the places that Franklin's singing might most powerfully orient a trans listening practice. Although she returns again and again to differently contoured articulation of how she is made to feel in her body, Franklin never directly refers to her body in a way that suggests she felt or feels that she had a prior claim to feeling like a natural woman in it. This is to say that her feeling does not change the shape of her body so much as it transforms a relationship to it, or transforms the story she is telling us about her relationship to it. In this way, Franklin is singing about a process that resonates with what Elias Krell has written about the embodied experience of transition. Krell writes, "Crucially, the contours of the physical body need not correspond linearly or simply with the felt sense of our bodies. Upon realizing I was trans, I felt as if I had settled down about 2 inches further into my body from a place where I had unknowingly been suspended or suspending myself." And when I read this, I remember saying, oh yeah, like I know exactly what you're talking about. What I'm getting from Krell here is that the process of naming their relation to their body as trans actually did something to their experience of embodiment without changing the shape of their body, but also in a way that's not entirely knowable by either them or somebody else. It's exclusively accessed through metaphor, but it's actually really important and actually changes the material circumstances of the situation. So here I want to pause to say, I'm talking about transition in a way that trans people speak about it, about transition amongst ourselves, as something that's a little bit distinct from the way that dominant non-trans narratives understand it. Aaron Azura writes about how the dominant models of narrating transition are, you know, someone goes away as one gender and comes back another, or there'll be a montage scene in a film in which it just all of a sudden somebody emerges spectacularly different. And this manages, this strategy manages moments of gender indeterminacy in a way that centers the feelings of non-trans people and sustains a normative imaginary of gender reassignment that happens elsewhere, never quite here. And it's true, as Azura maintains, that emphasis on surgery and discrete bounded times for transition, like a discrete moment of transition, can be important and are important to many trans people. But still, though, this narrative privileges the spectacle of medical transition over the myriad moments of unspectacular, everyday acts of recognition and care that make trans life livable and even at times pleasurable. What we might hear in A Natural Woman speaks to these moments of recognition and care, little moments in which transness is alive, if not visible, in our relations to ourselves and others. Hill Malatino writes about these moments of unspectacular care in their indispensable book, Trans Care. They're moments that mainstream trans representation occlude in service of other narratives and other ways of representing transness. Malatino points out that we are accustomed in popular representations of transgender life to see impeccably beautiful and deeply cis-passing trans women. Rarely do we see representations of folks in the midst of transition, trans guys with acne and cracked voices whose sebaceous glands are going wild, barefaced trans femmes who haven't yet shaved. We're flawed, imperfect, sometimes rough in our becomings. For me, this is a kind of beauty that trumps any seamless, airbrushed art of surfaces. But the folks who actively bless our mess are few and far between. The moments I'm talking about are also what Malatino points to in Mackenzie Wark and Andrea Long Chu's exchange, in which these two trans women are discussing how we are often supplicants, asking others to recognize our gender as part of our own being free. Malatino writes, in relationships structured by mutual indebtedness or reciprocal duty, where we know and thus owe the other, we usually get what we want insofar as gendered recognition is concerned. It's still a process of supplication, but in friendship, we're bossy bottoms, and our friends, are usually service tops. And I just want to go back to one sentence that I think is actually really, really important here. Malatino writes, "The folks who actively bless our mess are few and far between." And I think that that is the kind of care that I'm interested in searching for and finding elsewhere. "The transitive structure of the line, 'You make me feel like a natural woman,' dramatizes just this kind of care, in which the you recognizes and invites the I to fully inhabit the position of natural woman, to which previously that I may have felt actually like totally barred from." So as a song of transition, Aretha Franklin's recording of A Natural Woman is emblematic of what Emily Lordy calls soulless technique, a quote, mode of turning struggle into stylized survivorship in a way that can create a home of no home in the body and on the page and stage. The creation of home out of no home also names the work of gender transition. This act of creation is what makes trans lives lived, hence livable, in the words of Naomi Scheman. And what Krell identifies as a kind of settling into the same body with a difference, at least initially. And there's a, although it's also got a kind of slightly different name for that relation. So even for the depressive transsexual position that Awkward Rich fleshes out in his essay, the naming of transness is important, but not triumphant or transcendent here. That's to say that settling 2 inches down into one's body is not a universal experience. And it also doesn't eradicate the pain of embodiment so much as it might transform some of the relationship to that pain. So what a trans listening practice might hear in A Natural Woman is not a song about the spectacular transformation from assigned male at birth into a cis-passing woman, but rather the myriad forms of care and attention during sex, yes, but also outside, around, and outside of it that can assuage trans people's feelings of monstrosity without resolving or turning away from those moments of gender indeterminacy. What I hear in Aretha's singing is the myriad transitional moments in trans lives without privileging the spectacular fetishizing of transition as surgical body modification. Even while acknowledging how crucial surgical modification can be for making life livable for a lot of trans folks. What I hear in Aretha's incandescent performance of the word feel in like 100 different ways in this song, even though she only sings it 18 times, is an emphasis on perceptual receptiveness as enlivening that articulates through the language of gender without being reducible to its normative grammatical logic. And I want to be very clear. I'm not claiming Aretha as trans or any such thing, but I'm rather trying to point out how ordinary narratives of gendered life sound different when heard from trans perspectives and through trans analytics. Trans people of all races are understood to be monstrous instruments of social reproduction by so many people right now. For instance, J.K. Rowling and Abigail Schreier, it's hard to avoid these things, especially during Transgender Week of Awareness, right? As Schreier's paranoid subtitle to her also awfully titled book, Irreversible Damage, is "The Transgender Craze Seducing Our Daughters." And that tells us all that we need to know about the current panic over transness. Beyond that, though, there still has to be more to give to this music to combat an extractive mode of hearing Black music as emotional nourishment, even and especially because it has functioned as this kind of emotional nourishment, something to be digested for so many white people. And so it would be a mistake to read contemporary white transness as an analog to 1960s Black womanhood, precisely because of different relations to racial capitalism, the means of production, especially after the Bostock v. Clayton County Supreme Court case, which was recently decided in and, you know, upheld the rights, was supposedly upheld the rights of trans and gay employees not to be discriminated against on account of their transness or their homosexuality. What I'm trying to wrap my head around right now is how to make these connections with care in my own relationship to them without reproducing the way that academic scholarship excavates knowledge and pleasure from Black women's performance and repackages them for scholarly consumption. What care does this song demand of us, of scholars and listeners who willfully mishear it on some level to connect it to the concerns of trans studies now in this moment? I'm thinking about these things and how to attend to these tensions and problems without exactly trying to resolve or fix them, but to listen with care and not as a method of extraction. So one way to do that, I think, is to turn back to the institutional position of trans studies within the university, right? Thinking about trans people's multiple relations to the universities that make this type of academic possible, academic talk possible at all, like the moment that we are having now. A recently co-authored essay by Cassius Adair, Cameron Awkward Rich, and Amy Marvin is instructive here. They seek to organize the field of trans studies around an ethics of care rather than, say, a shared object of knowledge or a series of debates. Part of what this means is fighting for the conditions that make trans life more livable. For some of us, like me, a white Arab Jewish trans person with support from my biological family, that would be something like a stable job and time to write. For others, it's for the universities to stop encroaching on their neighborhoods, bringing increased police presence, rising property values that force them out of town. It would also mean getting rid of overturning FOSTA SESTA and other forms of legislation, decriminalizing sex work, and making lives less criminalized and more livable. As the authors point out, these are somewhat contradictory, right? On the one hand, I would like, and other trans people like me would want to have jobs that provide us with the time to write. And on the other hand, we also recognize how the university is actively destroying ways of life in the neighborhoods that they're gentrifying. Even so, we can demand them at the same time. What's clear is that to the extent that trans studies remain siloed and generally outside the curriculum and faculty expertise in most departments across most universities, or is taught as part of the guest artist style of teaching in women gender studies, i.e. there's a week on transness and that's it, it remains minoritized within all of our fields. A trans listening practice requires the institutional resources to be dedicated to this project. And yet overwhelmingly, most of the people poised to do this type of work are either grad workers who will be forced out of the academy upon graduation, or contingent faculty who work at multiple universities or other jobs to make ends meet and are likely soon to disappear from academic communities. These are not conditions in which projects on trans listening can thrive. And yet any institutional initiative to hire and retain trans faculty, and I'm not just talking about increasing tenure lines, I'm talking about working on behalf of contingent and non-tenure track faculty to make it possible for those jobs to be sustainable, right? So, but any institutional initiative to do those things will ultimately increase the precarity of trans life outside the university's institutional umbrella if it's not accompanied by the much more radical demands at times for universities to immediately defund police forces that routinely harass Black trans people in their home neighborhoods or students and faculty. And also as Adair and Marvin and Awkward Rich say, and also end the North American university's expansion into neighborhoods as a landlord, segregator, speculator, and evictor. These twin aims have to orient our current and future work in this current age of austerity. And that's the kind of trans listening practice that's grounded in material politics that I want to leave us with today. So thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you. That was amazing. It's like given me so much to think about. We've got time for questions. I have lots of questions. Can I start? One question I had it really intrigued me. The question of a trans listening practice that has to do with care, and you mentioned Suzanne Cusick. And I really loved that essay. And I was just thinking about how she envisions or visualizes that listening practice, which for her is a lesbian listening practice, where she says, you know, she wants her students and herself to be on our backs you know, with the music doing it to the person in their back. So, and it's like an interesting description of this kind of reception, but also an identification with the music. But she also acknowledges that this can mean that the music will tell us something that we don't know yet, or might have things to say that are completely different from what we expect to find, or like that is sort of outside of maybe the cultural and ideological expectations. So I'm wondering if that's where you see a parallel, or if there's also a kind of particular metaphor that you have in mind, or like I'm curious sort of what that would, if you had to describe it as an image, or what would, of the track compared to Cusick maybe in particular. Yeah.
That's a great question. I'm going to think about it for a second. I will say, like, so I teach Cusick's essay. I love that essay. And what I think I would pick up from Cusick, and what I've written about in other contexts, like in the Ellison essay that I think is aligned with this, but comes at it from a different angle, is the extent to which for Cusick listening is a fleshly process. I mean that flesh in the sense of partially kind of what Spillers is talking about, which is the sense of flesh is something that precedes the body, that it's the body before and also kind of outside the middle passage. So she's thinking about black flesh here, but I'm thinking about how for Cusick, I'll start that again. So for Cusick, listening is a specifically, and musical, also musical performance are really enliven her body. Like she talks about her hands so much, and her hands as in fact, like a sex mm-hmm. organ. And I think that what I would pull from that essay as aligned with what I would understand as a trans listening practice is that sense of bodily listening rather than listening that focuses primarily through the ear. So this is a little bit different than like aural studies. Like, yes, it matters what we hear, but also we need to be thinking about how this music is absorbed and enfleshed and kind of resonates and reverberates through our flesh. The thing that I would probably push back on, at least in this moment, against, in Cusick is, while I love that image, I find that the image of asking, in particular as a faculty member, students to like pretend the music is doing it to them is too, I feel like that can do some harm in that moment of teaching, in that, in particular, like, different people have different relationships to, say, being on their back, for instance. Yeah. And this idea, like, one of the problems with early gay and lesbian studies in particular is the analog between top and bottom and, like, on your back and on top. And, like, that's just not how top and bottom works in bodily relations. So I think that that's something that I think is a little different, and where I would point trans listening practices as different from Cusick's is being somewhat more attentive to the conditions in which and under which music was produced and created, both in its commodity forms as recording, but also as acoustic vibration.
Yeah, no, that's really great. I mean, I think she acknowledges that this is kind of, maybe a bit problematic, or what does that mean for a pedagogy? But I think it's also maybe provocative also just to think about or to acknowledge pleasure or embodiment in a pedagogical situation, full stop. So that's kind of,
I agree with you. I'll say that I will always in my teaching ask students to attend to the pleasure of the listening, but where I would draw the line would be at asserting how one might access that pleasure, what position I want somebody else's body in to access that pleasure, I think is a very 90s gender studies move. And a trans studies move is like, actually, your interiority can be opaque. I'm actually really interested in the opacity of the pleasure moment rather than trying to make it articulable. But I think that she's really interested in making it articulable.
Yeah, I love that. No, I think that's really great, really clear. Yeah, thank you. Other questions from people? questions or thoughts?
Maybe I'll just jump in because, I mean, you know, I just loved your careful reading of the Aretha Franklin, and, you know, it was just so beautifully done. And I also think playing the song twice makes all the difference. And so I think, you know, I applaud you for taking the time to play to us again. And that's something that I learned from Susan McLary, who does that all the time, who's, you know, starts by playing the music that she wants to talk about, then she talks about it, and then she plays it again so that you come back to the music in full knowledge of what the ground that you've covered in between your innocent reading, you know, your starting reading and what you know now. And I think, you know, that's really, it's an extremely good practice, I think. There's just so much. Sorry. I mean, really what I want to know is, what else are you going to do in your book?
That's a great question. I mean, right now, I think, I mean, the other, you know, the other moment that I think maybe co-articulates with this one is the chapter that's on the autobiography of an ex-colored man, which is something that I was thinking about how to, if I could incorporate here. There just wasn't the time, and I wanted to be able to flesh out and be able to trace. It was really important to me in this talk to be trying to do a citational practice that takes us through trans studies and through the formative thinkers. In order to do that, I needed to like put some of my work, other work in the background, because I suspected that some folks who would be here might not be as familiar with all of these different thinkers. But I would turn to, so there's a chapter on the autobiography of an ex-colored man, and that is really focused on that early like hysterical moment around, especially around ragtime music, but also weirdly Chopin. And I think that the gendering of Frederic Chopin's music in the 19th century is something where they kind of take things up. One of the things that's important to me about 19th century music in the United States is that what separates the music that Black musicians were producing and the music that white musicians were producing is that white musicians had the capacity to navigate the sexual dimorphism in their music. So all of the writing about Beethoven and Chopin is talking for a portion of time by white critics was like, oh, there's like the blend of masculine and feminine here. And, you know, we better watch out though, because the Chopinization of American music is feminizing all the boys. And we can't have that, because that's gonna lead to the end of civilization as we know it. And at the same time, Chopin was like understood as morbidly feminine and like just atrociously effeminate. So that chapter is about Johnson's book, The Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man, in which the narrator of that book is a Black man who ends up passing as white, and he's a pianist. And so much of his relationship to the world is mediated through his relationship to the piano, also a feminized instrument at that in the late 19th and early 20th century. Most of the prior scholarship on the book has treated the narrator's moments of feminization. He worries routinely about feminization throughout the book and being feminized. And most of the times that's been read as symptomatic of his male homosociality. And it's the kind of classic queer theory move of, oh, there's a person who is assigned male at birth and demonstrating traits that are associated with femininity, that is a reference in some way to homosocial desire or homosexuality. But what I find in the book, because he has this strong musical affinity for Frederic Chopin, is that that Chopin invites the intimacy with his white wife, and it frames their interracial marriage as a form of feminized homosociality, because of the way that the music invites a feminized understanding of him. So racial passing in the book coincides not only with a disavowal of Black manhood, it's also coterminous with a longing for femininity. And at this point in my voice is kind of shot from talking, but so there's a chapter on James Weldon Johnson and these transgressions of boundaries between white and black musical genres as transgressions of proper sexual differentiation. There's a chapter that's on Ralph Ellison listening in this, basically that chapter is kind of about listening on the subjunctive, in the subjunctive mode, thinking about what might we hear in Ellison's music writing if we attend to the black women's musical labor that makes it possible for him to write about the blues. So in Invisible Man, rather than focusing primarily on Louis Armstrong and his version of what did I do to be so black and blue, I listen to Ethel Waters's and Edith Wilson's versions and think about what it what it would mean to listen to Ellison against his masculinist tendency in his music writing. And then there's a chapter on Philippa Schuyler and her totally amazing annotational relationship with her sheet music and the way that she feminizes a Beethoven sonata via her, like by making the theme into Carmilla, the like the 19th century lesbian vampire novel. And that's really about how she tries to navigate a, it's also materialist in the sense I'm trying to show how she navigates a very masculinist world in which her access to concerts was exclusively in the 50s and late 40s, 50s and 60s via male impresarios who all were trying to sleep with her. And she had to navigate all sorts of awful violence, basically, to in order to try to have her career, and ultimately left the field of musical performance. And then a chapter on male homosociality and the transitivity of the song My Favorite Things from Sound of Music to John Coltrane's band, arguing that one of the core effects or one of the core ways that that song became so seductive and popular was because it gathered black men together to play a white woman's song. Oh. So that's kind of the overarching, those are most of the things that I talk about.
That sounds amazing. I look forward to reading it.
Yeah. I have one more question, if you're happy to answer it, but just because you mentioned transitivity, and I really liked what you said about thinking about transness through the metaphor of like the transitive verb, and kind of how the transitive verb needs an object. And I felt that there was also a connection there with what you said about care and maybe interdependence, you know, like this, there's obviously a lot at the moment also from like disability studies thinking about interdependency and thinking about care and sort of like this embrace of, you know, needing others. Well, I wondered if that's also, if that's how you see it, like understand like the transitive, or if the transitive verb also means that this object is that is that always needs to happen for the transitive verb to work, or that it leaves this kind of something for the imagination to do, that this is sort of the work of poetry, or that this is what you mentioned when you talked about sort of something being accessed through metaphor. I don't know. So these are just some thoughts that I couldn't yet connect, but were really, I don't know, stimulating or like inspiring for me to think about. Because I'm super interested also in like, how, again, like what you said about attunement, or, and I was thinking about orientation, and maybe also Sarah Ahmed, and like how this is like an embodied orientation. And I think that's also where it came from. And with my question about what do you envision, what that position might be, that trans listening position, or maybe it is like a transitive position or a different, or an orientation in a space that it, that we can't yet picture because it is, well, I don't know, just riffing here.
No, that's great. I think those are, it's a great question. I mean, I think that part of the care that I'm talking about, I guess I say a couple of things. Part of the care that I'm thinking about is our mutual aid networks and other ways that people organize care and attention to each other horizontally that's not always mediated through institutions. So I think I don't approach it from the standpoint of trying to figure out what position I want a listener to be in. And I think of it more, in terms of a body, but I do think about it in terms of what is somebody's positionality with respect to their institutional, their relationships to institutions. And that's something that I'm still really trying to work out because, as it stands, like the likelihood is that I and most of my other colleagues who are doing trans study stuff may not even be able, like, I have a book. I know what it is. I do the work for it, but I fully expect not to have the institutional support to write the book in a way that will, that will produce an academic press monograph. So one of the things I'm thinking about in terms of care there and transitivity is how do I transform this book that I've envisioned as something oriented towards an academic audience into something that might be more oriented towards a popular audience? Mm-hmm. How would I think about transitivity and grammar there as I shift it to a book that's usable by a larger population in particular that is more more available to trans people? Kind of inside and outside the academy. And so I guess that for me, what's important about the transitive grammar is that it's not exactly a metaphor. It is like a material relation. Mm-hmm. And that one of the things that I would ask of listeners is to enter that kinds of transitive relationship in an open way to the music that we're listening to and or we're writing about or thinking about, whatever position that requires somebody to be in, or however that person might do that. But I think that the primary thing that I would be suggesting is how do we think about listening with our bodies and our full flesh rather than just the ears.
Yeah, I think, for me, I think they can be connected, sort of like the embodied and the metaphorical. And I'm also just thinking of Andrea Long Chu's notion of like desire or projection or like that is still like grounded in, you know, in a bodily experience. I also thought of this in terms of, you know, Sarah Ahmed's writing about orientation because she also uses grammar in like interesting ways or grammatical relationships. How we might be, and Sedgwick as well, you know, being beside, being alongside, you know, these kinds of that propose other relationships towards objects, towards subjects, to, you know, being in a space. So I think, yeah, I don't know, for me, I'm interested in sort of how something can be both metaphorical and then also kind of really material and embodied.
Yeah, I think that that's a great, I mean, I think that there is a shuttling across the metaphorical or almost like linguistic or representational. Part of that has to do with the way that language is just going to be producing metaphorical relations, and language as a representational medium is never going to fully access the kind of experience. And so I think that with those things in mind, it's important to be thinking about the two together and the way that language produces material effects that extend, that have strong implications, especially in areas like the law, for instance, in which the criminalization of trans people in particular ends up really making, I think actually performing a lot of discipline, like material discipline, towards other people who may not be trans because of the way that the language for talking about transness, it like pushes towards the deviance that is criminalized. So I'm thinking kind of on my feet here, but it's a great question.
Thank you so much. I don't know if we have any more questions, but this has been really wonderful and so rich and Yeah, I hope I can, is the link, will that still be up? Because I hope I can keep sort of going back to it, or will that still be available? That would be great.
I think it'll still be available for a little bit, and then I'm going to probably take it down.
Yeah.
Because I'm going to keep working. I need to, this is the next thing that I'm working on. Like mm-hmm. I just finished the Ellison thing, was finished and sent out a couple months ago. So this is the next thing. But I think I'm going to try to orient this current version maybe towards a more popular venue, in order to see how I might make the work available differently than through, you know, the like 2 year lag time.
I think that would be amazing. And also, I mean, I think increasingly within academia, there's also more acceptance for things that are, you know, published outside of peer reviewed venues. Mm-hmm. I'm all for that. I think that sounds great.
Awesome. Well, thank you both for inviting me. Thanks everybody who's still here for attending. I really appreciate it. And I don't know if people have my email, but if anybody wants, I would love, you know, feedback and like from anyone who has it, so that I can incorporate as I keep going.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Awesome. Thank you all. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye. Yeah.
Bye. Bye.